Welcome to the Sonic Temple Podcast. I'm Francis.
And I'm Jeff.
And today we have Sarah Oli here with us, and she has chosen Everlong by Foo Fighters.
So I selected Wave of Mutilation by the Pixies.
And then I went with Love Like Blood by Killing Joke. This is being recorded on May 22nd, 2023?
Yeah.
Sounds about right. All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Today we have Sarah Oli in the Sonic Temple. And Sarah is the co-host of the Blue Flag Podcast, along with our friend Breno, who we had on last episode. Blue Flag Podcast is your last place finish for Formula One racing podcasts. We are very excited to have Sarah here in the Sonic Temple with us, so thank you for coming by, and welcome.
Yay. Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome, Sarah.
Happy to be here. Happy to learn about some new music.
All right, so tell us what you picked and why.
I went with something that I think is very easy, and I was a little worried about going this easy, but maybe not for everyone. It's Everlong by Foo Fighters. You said last time that you feel bad having to pick a favorite song.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the same way, but there's nothing that compares to Everlong for me.
I'm with you. It's an unbelievable song that in much the same, we'll talk about this a lot, I'm sure, but in much the same way that Smells Like Teen Spirit sort of redefined the beginning of the 90s, I feel like Everlong redefined the end of the 90s for alternative rock. But please continue with your explanation of why.
No, I like that. So it came out in 1997. I was a little bit young for the debut of the song, but once I hit high school, Foo Fighters was all we talked about. I was in band, so of course the drums are the most important part of Foo Fighters.
And amen, sister. Yes. Of everything, really. Period. What, yes. What instrument did you play?
I played flute.
Okay. All right. So not drums.
Not drums. No.
Fair enough.
One of my friends played drums, and she was one that kind of introduced me to it. And by the time I saw Foo Fighters in 2018, I think she'd seen them 15 times.
Uh-huh.
So very into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Everlong has traveled with me through my teens, through adulthood. You can really put it to anything. The lyrics are very simple. When you think about them, just set them apart from the actual instrumentation themselves. And there's an acoustic version, which if you're feeling like something a little bit slower, the acoustic version is really good. It was never meant to be an acoustic version. Dave Grohl has said that it's supposed to have been a rock song, and he just decided to do an acoustic version, played it for the first time on an acoustic guitar for the Howard Stern show.
Yeah, yeah.
Typical Dave Grohl stuff, but no matter your mood, you can set it to Everlong.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I was watching Taylor in an interview, and he was talking about that, and he was saying how Everlong, like, it was hard for me to remember back and remember. It wasn't that big of a hit when it first came out, and it really is what Taylor was. I mean, it was a hit. It was on MTV a lot because that video is bonkers and amazing. And we'll talk about that,
oh, yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But he was saying, he's like, it wasn't like the Everlong that we know now until Dave did that acoustic version on the Howard Stern show.
And now I know you've always been out of your head, out of my head, I sang. And I sing along with you. If everything could ever feel this real forever, if anything could ever be this good again.
The only thing I'll ever ask of you, you gotta promise not to stop when I say you. When I
kind of gave it this new life, maybe because it allowed people to focus in on the lyrics more than just the asinine bombasticness of that of the, you know, rock track. So it just kind of gave it a whole new audience, I think, and really propelled it up to this massive. I mean, it is. It's one of the defining songs of like rock in the 90s.
And you wrote it in 45 minutes.
And it's crazy
how it goes with songs like those.
Sometimes.
Yeah, the background is he was going through a divorce. Some of the band members had quit. He was sleeping on someone's floor in, I think, their basement. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it about the girl he was in love with at the time, who was Lewis Post.
Lewis Post, yeah.
The best band name ever, Veruca Salt.
Absolutely.
Love yeah. that name.
Yep, and you hear her voice on the record too.
Mm-hmm. She said.
Breathe out so I can breathe you in. Real forever. If anything could ever be this good again, the only thing I'll ever ask of you, you gotta promise not to stop when I say when she said.
Yeah, you can hear. And with that's cool because it's the song is about being in love with someone so much that you harmonize with them. And here Dave has the woman that he was in love with on the track.
Yeah, there you go.
When they recorded, I heard that it was over the telephone that they recorded her vocals.
Right, right.
And one of the whispers was a love letter to her, which didn't end up making the cut.
Right. Instead, there's that weird whisper track in the middle, mm-hmm. which is like some weird story that one of their guitar techs told about having to hold his dad's boots above his head.
Yeah.
So weird. But just because there's a couple things about this song. So to go back to the point about it not being like this major hit right off the bat, you can tell like this is the weirdest track placement for a song like this ever. It's track 11 right. on a 14 track album. Like you don't put a song that you think is going to be a hit in that like, position.
Yeah, like on the beginning of the fourth act, basically, or whatever.
I was playing the record for my son, and he's like, where's Everlong? I was like, clicking through the track. Eventually. He's like, why is it all the way down here? I'm like, dude. Because they just didn't know, mm-hmm. you know? And even more to the point, like, if you think a song is going to be like this massive hit single, like, you don't put a weird story about some dude holding boots above it. Yeah, like, you maybe think through that a little bit more, but...
No, it becomes part of the lore.
It is. But also, I'm going to counterbalance everything I just said with, you know, when Gil Norton, the producer, is on record as saying, like, when I heard Everlong, I knew that that was, like, I knew we had a record at that point. Hmm. So I don't know. I guess Gil believed in it, but...
After the fact, he's Monday morning quarterback.
Maybe that's it. I mean, they put it 11th on the record, which is weird.
When you think about it from a music standpoint, it seems very clinical. Like I kept playing it over and over again, and it's a routine rock dynamic where you have the loud, soft, loud,
right.
which is inspired by the Pixies, I think.
Totally.
Oh, yeah.
100%.
So they're playing something that they know works, mm-hmm. and then you just have a slow introduction of all of the instruments. Mm-hmm. So it's typical, you would think, of a rock song where you have Dave coming in, then the guitars, and then you have what sets everything off is the top hat. I never thought I would say the top hat really makes the song.
The hi-hat.
The hi-hat, yeah.
Yes, yeah. It does. It does. It's very fast. The 16th notes on the hi-hat are super fast. I mean, this song is a workout to play.
Yeah, it's fun watching Taylor play it.
Oh my gosh. I mean, rest in peace, Taylor Hawkins. But yeah, I mean, it is really fun to watch him play it, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So as a drummer, is these drum parts, is that typical Dave Grohl style?
No.
So as I was thinking, because he had William Goldsmith in the band at the time.
Yeah.
When I was listening, I was like, is this a Dave Grohl style? Because it sounds more like Dave Grohl playing William Goldsmith, almost, like with some of like the fills and stuff. Out of the pitch. Comes in.
Yeah.
It felt a lot like his style.
Mm.
So I don't know. I was just...
No, so that's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, but as Sarah pointed out, William was already basically out at that point. And I think like when Dave went in, so they started recording the record with the full band at one studio. And, you know, famously, it was not going well. And then they took a break. And then Dave and Gil Norton basically decided we're going to retrack the drums on this whole thing. But it was during that break that Dave wrote and demoed Everlong. So William never played Everlong, as far as I know.
Right. I was just thinking, like,
as far as the timeline.
I was just thinking, like, stylistically.
Right, stylistically. You know, there's a weird thing with the Foo Fighters. Like, if you are keyed in, so Nate Mendel, the bass player, and William Goldsmith, the original drummer, were both in a band called Sunny Day Real Estate.
We can go back to a previous episode if you want to check that out.
But there's definitely a thing with Foo Fighters that every once in a while, like, they sure sound a lot like Sunny Day sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, they'll break into a bridge part.
There's parts on this song, totally.
And there's parts on this song that, like, you get that flavor, which is cool because obviously Dave was a fan.
Oh, totally.
But talking about the guys from Sunny Day, so William Goldsmith and Nate Mendel in the Foo Fighters documentary Back and Forth, because I watched it this weekend with my son, because he needed to know.
It's the first time he's seen it?
First time he had seen it.
Oh, wow.
I've seen it
30
times, but yeah, it was the first time for him. And my son's a drummer, so, you know, it was definitely like mandatory viewing.
Yes.
Sit down, boy. We're doing this. But in the documentary, Nate Mendel says about Gil Norton that he came in and immediately started referring to them as the rhythmless section, which is brutal.
Ouch.
I mean, as brutal as it gets. So he definitely broke them down. And, you know, Nate Mendel was like, that made me want to get better as a player. And William Goldsmith was like, I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Mm.
So, you know, that's how that played out. But
anyway. One rose up to the challenge, the other one.
I know. I was explaining that to my son.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lesson here, kiddo.
It's like those head coach rules. You got to know how to treat every one of your players. A good coach will.
Yeah. Or, I mean,
you got to know what each player needs to up your game.
Yeah. Or know which player to put in when you need a star.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they did.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's no, if you got Dave Grohl sitting on the bench.
Yeah, it's not like that. It's not like that look far for a drummer.
It's,
yeah.
it's not too hard to call him in.
Yeah, so he played it for the album, right? And mm-hmm. then because Taylor had just started, I mean, he was on the music video, but he wasn't right. actually the one who recorded the track.
Right. He joined after the album was done. Yeah.
And you were talking about how they sometimes sound like other bands. And apparently with Everlong, when he was first riffing it, it sounded a lot like Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
So he actually had them listen to it to make sure that it wasn't another... You know, under pressure.
or Killing Joke situation, yes. which we're yes. going to get to later in this episode. It wouldn't have been Dave's first time with something like that.
Going back to like your whole like how it sounds a bit like Sunny Day and stuff, and like yeah. the whole, that's what Foo Fighters to me was very like. This song was very like bringing that 90s emo flavor, but like more in the mainstream.
Totally,
like because you totally hear it in the guitar parts with the octaves racing up.
So many guitars on this record, on this song, you know, and it made me realize like, oh, that's kind of why they have three guitar players in the band.
Right.
Like you kind of need it, you know. Which this song was just such a sonic quantum leap for the band, you know, like coming from, and I'll talk more about this when we get to my song too, but coming from that first record that was just Dave to this, I mean, I don't, it's just a quantum leap, you know, in songwriting and sonics and everything. I mean, this really took Foo Fighters to the next level for sure.
Yeah, I would say that they peaked probably with Color and Shape, just because of they put everything that is the Foo Fighters into one album and they've recreated it since. But that's the album I always come back to. And maybe it's just yeah. my age and the times.
Right.
But you can't really get better than that.
Oh, man. I don't know. I might argue that.
Yeah.
There are records that I absolutely love. But I hear what you're saying. Like the nice thing about the Foo Fighters is that it's just a great catalog. So there's so much good stuff everywhere. But yeah, I mean, if you got a record with Monkey Wrench and Everlong on it, it's going to be hard to top.
Yeah. And apparently it was David Letterman's favorite song.
Absolutely was.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's a fun fact. Yeah. He had him play it. Was it the show before his surgery or after?
After surgery.
When he came back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When we started talking about doing the show, when I came back after the surgery, we were talking about, well, what do you want for music? And I said, well, you know, something peppy. And And these guys were on the show, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and they played this song, and it's a great song, and Paul plays it every now and then on the show. Yeah. And I love the song, and I love the band, and I said, well, what about those guys? What about Foo Fighters? And it was, so they're touring South America. That's what we heard. Is that right?
Yeah, but we blew it up.
They canceled the tour to be here tonight. It's their current CD. It's called Nothing Left to Lose. Ladies and gentlemen, my favorite band playing my favorite song, Foo Fighters.
And then they played his very last show ever.
That's cool. Yeah.
Talking about the Foo Fighters is so much fun because they're just a fun band that, like,
I mean, look at
brings the world so much joy.
Yes.
Yeah, like Dave Grohl, you can always tell, is like the guy that's just having, he knows where he's at and he's just going to have a good time doing it.
That's it.
And he does.
Mm. And he does.
He has a great time.
He's got the Paul McCartney thing, which is like, he knows he's Dave Grohl or Paul McCartney. And like, they just go around bringing joy to the world, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
did you ever watch him on the Hot Ones Wings Challenge?
No.
He made the guy cry. One, he got him insanely drunk because after every wing, he would do a shot. And the guy just got so drunk and he was so excited to be with Dave Grohl, hearing all these stories that at the end, you just see him weeping and hugging him. It's the best one.
That's awesome. That's great. Awesome.
I can't tell you what this means to the internet.
Get emotional.
Get
the
fuck. No, I might
get
though.
That guy at the bar.
No, I do. I care. I care. Let's hug.
Their carpool karaoke is like my son's favorite thing in the world. It's so funny. Like, they're so great. They're just a joy machine, you know?
Yeah. Clearly shows in all their videos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How much fun they have with everything.
And this one.
Yeah, let's go to this
video.
Yeah,
let's talk about it. I mean, Michelle Gondry, right, was doing all these weird, wacky Bjork videos and whatnot, and they pull him in for this. And they were talking about in the documentary, and they said, like, the original treatment was like, he was explaining it to me, and it was taking like an hour and a half for him to explain it. And I was like, you got three and a half minutes, man. I don't know how you're gonna do all this. But who was the original? Oh, Daryl Hannah was supposed to be his love interest.
Really?
Splash? That was Michelle Gondry's initial, like, idea.
Splash. A fantastic tale about a fantastic tale.
Come on in. The water's fine.
And then, I guess, Taylor joins the band, and you're like, he's a lot prettier than
honestly,
Daryl
that was
Hannah.
The only
Let's
thing
put
I was
him in a
about.
Dress, and we're good. It wouldn't be the last time they dressed him up. And yeah, no, with good reason. Oh, man. My wife called me from tour one night because she was a musician and she was on tour playing a festival and they were playing with the Foo Fighters. And she's like, I was just in a elevator with Taylor Hawkins. And I was like, great. You know, to quote Lebowski, how are you going to keep them down on the farm once they've met Taylor Hawkins? You know, jeez, she's never going to look at me the same. Never been so insecure in my life. Like, you can't be that close to him. That's not fair.
Mm-mm.
Oh, man.
Good looking dude. I miss him. Rest in peace.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was one of the more traumatic moments for me.
For sure.
Was finding out that he passed. And Everlong was the last song he played live, too.
That's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is really heartbreaking. I think I was thinking a lot about it at the time, especially in, like, why that hit so much harder than any other, like, celebrity death, you know? And I think it's just because he and Dave, more than any other band members in any other band, like, lived out their relationship like
in front of everyone.
Like, it was such a big part of that band, was like, these two guys are just like,
it was almost like a sitcom playing out.
It
in front
was
of everyone.
Like a sitcom. That's exactly right. Yeah. And so to just miss one, and then you just feel bad for Dave and all the trauma he's been through in his life. And it is soul crushing, the absence of him.
I thought about that when I saw them live, because again, it was just one time, but I love music, obviously. I've been moved by it, but I've never had a come apart just from being in the presence of anyone. Mm-hmm. And I had that feeling, especially when they played Everlong, because it was the last song, of thinking the reverberations through my feet are from Taylor. I'm listening with my own ears to Dave. And it really affected me in a way that I've never felt. And I don't know why Foo Fighters, I don't know why Everlong, but it has stuck with me.
Because it's great.
It's got the magic.
It's great. The magic.
Yeah. So when you saw him live, did they do it electric? Like with the drums and everything?
Oh, yeah.
See, I've only seen him live once, and he did it acoustic.
Oh, is that right?
And I was so disappointed. I mean, it sounded good, but I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay, maybe like during the whisper part, they'll come in and like full band and everyone. And it never happened.
It didn't happen.
And I was like, I'm like, I was waiting the whole time for this.
It was their closing song, their very last song. And I refused to leave until they played it.
Yeah.
And it meant we were stuck in the parking lot for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And it was worth it's worth it. Hour and a half.
Yeah, it's worth it.
Totally.
Always worth it.
And that, again, that is such a challenge to close with that song. Like if you're Taylor and you've been playing your ass off for 2 hours and you're looking at the set list and you've got that one as like, you got to keep it up for that one. That's a workout, man. He was an athlete, that guy.
Oh, yeah.
And now we got?
Good luck to Josh Freese.
Yep.
it's on him. But, you know.
He's solid.
He's the best of the best.
Yeah.
I mean, period. There's no one better for the job. That's for sure. So you could have found someone more. I don't know. I've seen friends of mine, former guests of this podcast, saying that it's a boring pick. And I get that. I understand what they're saying. Like Josh Freese is.
But it's the right
pick.
He's
the automatic guy, you know. Yeah. But it's the right pick.
It's the right
pick.
Like
no one's going to do it as well as he will. So. Good luck, Josh. Can't wait to see you. I'm going.
Ooh, let's go back to the video.
Yeah, let's go back to Michel Gondry and the weird, wacky the video.
So it starts off with, what, Sid and Nancy?
Yeah, totally.
Like
yeah.
And then goes into Evil Dead, one of my favorite movies.
Right.
The whole Evil Dead in the cabin with the trap door at the bottom.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Hey, I'll swallow your soul. I'll swallow your soul. I'll swallow your soul.
Swallow this. Groovy.
Yeah. And then the big hand thing. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah. I don't know if that's like a whole just a whole like pimp slap thing. I don't know.
it's a wild ride, man. But it was nonstop on MTV at that time, which was fantastic. All the Foo Fighters videos were
because of a video.
They just had such a great sense of humor, you know, and it really showed through and it really made them. It wasn't stupid and cheesy the way Blink 182 was. You know what I mean? Right. Like there, it was the right amount of humor and, you know, we don't take ourselves so seriously.
Right. It's like we're all in on this joke.
The song is badass.
We're all in on this joke type.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
We can have fun with this weird format we're all slaves to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they didn't even perform for the whole song. They had to add an extra bit so that we could actually see
like
the whole band
longer than the
again because he had like this you know 300 page treatment for it.
Yeah,
good point. And they're like, hold on, we need to actually like show that we have instruments,
right? Yeah, that's the best part when Taylor like throws off the sheets and he's got the little kit and he's going to town on it.
It's amazing. Good stuff.
So I kind of alluded to this a little bit before, but there was this massive quantum leap in the Sonics and the performances on the record between the first Foo Fighters record, which was famously just Dave and a 24-track recorder. It was supposed to be demos, but turned out to be, you know, the full record. And then this album, the second album, Color and the Shape, and that's due to the producer that they chose named Gil Norton. And the reason it sounds so much more dense and perfect, because Color and the Shape is a perfect record, is because Gil Norton is very famously like a taskmaster of a producer. He's very, very hard on the performers. If he doesn't like the way you played the take on the 43rd time, he's going to make you do it a 44th time, and then 65th time, and then 92nd time. He drives them down. But Gil Norton gets away with it because he makes amazing records, such as the Pixies. So he did the second Pixies album, and then the third and the fourth Pixies album, which are like the three that...
Yeah, they're all good.
Well, they're all good. Yeah. I'm not going to say that. But certainly, like, he did Pixies' Doolittle and Trompe Le Monde, and those are the records that made Dave Grohl want to hire him as a producer. Mm-hmm. And so it's what made me pick the Pixies' Wave of Mutilation. Comes off the Pixies' second album, Doolittle, which was very much sort of the same story. Like, the first Pixies album was done with Steve Albini, who famously is like a non-producer. Like, he doesn't really, the band's going to do what the band's going to do, and he's just going to record it. So it's very, you know, kind of simplistic in that regard. But then they, for their second album, they brought in Gil Norton, and he did the same thing with them that he did with the Foo Fighters, which is throw a bunch more guitars on it and double track some vocals. And he tried to encourage them to lengthen their songs, but they weren't having it. But ultimately, what you get out of it is an absolute classic of alternative rock music, which is Doolittle. So anyone who doesn't have this record needs to go get it immediately. And if you want, I mean, the first song on the record is Debaser. That's a great place to start. But Wave of Mutilation has been my favorite Pixie song since I very first heard it. So that's the song I picked.
And very, very good that you picked it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Thanks,
I mean, Doolittle's a masterpiece.
It's an absolute masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece. It's a game changer. I mean, you had brought up earlier the whole quiet, loud, quiet, loud.
Mm-hmm.
Pixies are the blueprint.
I think that's the name of the documentary about the Pixies.
It is, right?
Yeah, totally makes sense. I mean, they're the blueprint for that, which translated to Nirvana, which translates into, you know, Foo Fighters and, and on and on and on. And like
a billion whole, other bands.
Yeah, Sunny Day Real Estate and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the blueprint.
Indeed. If you just pop this song on the way it starts with the drums and when the guitar comes screeching in. And then the bass half a second later.
Yeah.
I mean, it just builds in this way that is perfect. And this song's only 2 minutes long. And I love that because I'm on a quest right now. You guys don't know this. I'm on a quest right now for 2 minute songs because my kids need them to brush their teeth. Huh. So we use We Will Rock You because it's perfect 2 minutes. And right when the guitar comes in, that's like when they can start their rinse brush cycle. It's like the perfect song. But this is also 2 minutes. So I'm like, good, we got something. We'll mix it up a little bit. Nice. You know?
So brush your teeth.
I love that.
That's going to be a core memory for them.
Yeah, I love that for sure. I love that this song is 2 minutes long. You don't need it to be any longer.
No, it's perfect how it is because it gets the point that it needs to get across. It's there. It's done. And when it's done, you're like, how is it already done? I got to listen to it again.
That's it, man.
It's like, yeah.
And because it moves so quickly, like from the tom parts to the double time parts to... Everything about it is so...
It's just a quick verse, chorus again, bye.
Yeah, it's so tight and concise, but there's so much going on in it that, yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's
the guitars just have like so much room at the beginning, and then everything again, it has the octaves. It's like
everything does, man. That's a Gil Norton. Some producers are just able to like somehow create more space than others in a way that you can really hear all the individual components, you know, so clearly. And I mean, this song is perfect in that way.
Yeah. I wrote down drums, toms.
So big.
Yeah.
They're so big, and it's such a great rolling.
And what's cool is like if you just hone in on like just the bass, like especially near the end, House is just like hitting the bass, like every note's just hitting, like matching what he's hitting on the drums, like the whole time. There's no, it's like. All the fills and everything, she's just matching it.
Yeah,
Kim Deal's matching it on
the great
bass.
Kim Deal. Yeah, yeah.
This is like the third time we've come up with Kim Deal on the spot.
I know. Yeah, yeah. She's a frequent, you know, guest, not guest,
friend of the
spotlight.
Pod.
Yeah. No, we wish. Yeah, man. And Joey Santiago, like the guitar lines are so surf guitar-y. Just,
yeah.
The Pixies are such a weird band that they're so beautiful. I don't know. Did you know this song, Sarah, before
no.
you? Okay.
I have heard songs off of Doolittle, but I've never gone through the whole album before. So when I saw where it was from, I was like, how did I miss this?
Huh? Right. Well, because it wasn't a single, which is crazy to me, but
it might be the song length. I was shocked when I saw 2 minutes. Like, that can't be right. There must be a longer version or for the album or
something. Well, there is. There's a longer version.
Yes.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no. But that's, I think that's part of it is I wonder if they were just thinking it's another point in the story of the album, but not something that they wanted to highlight.
Yeah, I don't know.
could just be a marketing thing. Like,
yeah, I mean,
some guy at the label just like, eh, no, I mean, we're go with this song.
The lyrics are about a disgraced Japanese businessman driving his car off a cliff into the ocean, committing suicide. Because that was apparently a thing that was happening a lot in the news, and Frank Black caught on to that and was like, that's a crazy thing. I'm going to write a song about it. So that's what the wave of mutilation is actually, but like drive my car into the ocean, you know? So maybe they're like, it doesn't really scream commercial right. appeal, you know?
It's a little bit downer.
But weirdly, like wave of mutilation is the title of their greatest hits record.
Yeah.
And it's like on Rolling Stone's top 10 readers poll of Pixie songs, it was like third or fourth. So it's a thing. It's a fan favorite. And I think that might have something to do with the fact that there's two versions of the song yeah. that are both equally amazing. And one is slightly longer. Because it's slower.
It's slower.
So you got a 2-minute fast thing and a 3-minute
more chilled out.
I mean, gorgeously chilled out.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, I fell in love with this song. It was the first Pixie song I ever heard. And where'd I hear it, Francis?
Pump up the volume.
My favorite movie of all time.
Guess who?
You sit next to him all year.
You out there? You listening?
And never notice him.
Can almost taste it, the rankness in the air.
He's the guy who lights up the night.
He's got a pirate radio station.
They say that I am
deluged. Oh, demented.
Hallelujah.
Well, guess what I say?
Christian Slater.
Get crazy!
Pump up the volume. Rated R. Preview Sunday, August 19th. Opens August 22nd.
You can't deny that early 90s Christian Slater.
1990 Christian Slater, man. I mean, this was like pre-Alternative Nation. I've talked about on this podcast before. It's the best soundtrack ever.
Yeah, it's...
But it's impossible tough. To find.
Mm-hmm.
And good luck finding Pump Up the Volume, the movie. It's not streaming anywhere, so...
That's why you got to have the DVDs like I do.
I need to borrow that. But yeah, I mean, this song hits at like this crucial moment in the movie, and you just see Christian Slater walking across sort of like suburban Arizona. They're building track houses, like building the suburbs, and he's just depressed and walking along, and this song's playing in the background, and I will never get that image out of my head. It's seared in. And I love it. Like, it's so good. This version is so good.
And this is the UK surf version.
Yeah. And it's not just me that can't pick between the two. Like, the band,
they'll play both.
They'll play both
yeah.
live. Yeah. So they bounce back and forth between them, too.
Yeah.
Because you can't pick. They're both amazing.
So is there a story behind the UK surf? Do we know anything about it?
I don't
find much about it.
Can't find anything. I don't even know if Gil Norton produced it. I would assume so. There's a version.
We might be able to check. Hold on.
There's like a box set that came out, and there's actually like 4 versions of this song. And 2 are very, very demo-y. And then there's the UK surf version, and then the version that ended up on Doolittle. What are you looking at there, Francis? Francis is pulling things from the archives here.
All right. I just pulled out the Pixies' Here Comes Your Man 12-inch single, and it has Wave of Mutilation on it. My eyes suck and there's no light over here. If you can read any of that, I think that font size is maybe 2.
Oh yeah, no, I can't read that.
I don't know if it says anything.
So it was recorded somewhere else. Edinburgh? Maybe? I can't read that. engineered by somebody else. So I think it was recorded somewhere else. So I don't know who.
Maybe it was a demo.
It doesn't say produced. It says engineered. So maybe the band self-produced it because they were just like on tour and recorded it. Some
use technology to make it bigger.
Well, and to see. Yeah, Edinburgh. So recorded at Palladium Edinburgh, engineered by John Turner. So I don't know that name.
And this is for UK Surf?
Yeah, this is for UK Surf. Here Comes Your Man was recorded in Boston, Mass. By Gil Norton. Yeah, so I don't think there's a producer on that on that version. I think it's probably just produced by the band and then engineered by whoever was in the studio that day, you know, when they stopped in. So, yeah, it's impossible to find any information because the only place that I ever knew of it from was the CD from Pump Up the Volume, but I didn't dig that out from my parents' attic. I didn't have time. It's in a box somewhere. But I love that version. Did you listen to that version?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Just so different. Again, kind of like the Foo Fighters acoustic version. Depends on what the mood is, but it's not an acoustic version. It's just a whole nother genre almost of you just want to chill with it.
That's it. Yeah. It's like chill surf.
Yeah. I love the name of like UK surf.
Yeah.
It's like, I guess because there's not too many waves out. Like, I don't.
Or because it was apparently recorded in Edinburgh. So.
There you go.
Maybe
there it is.
There it is.
Could make sense.
Recorded in UK.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. My favorite part is always the line, the Find My Way to Mariana. Just how he says that.
Yeah. Could find my way to Mariana.
Could find my way to Mariana.
And he's talking about the Mariana Trench.
Yeah.
Right? Which is weird. And he also talks about El Nino.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, what would that be? Like, that would be like 4 or 5 years before El Nino actually became a thing, though, that Americans talked about. So it was a really weird reference.
Yo soy El Nino. For those of you who don't habla Espanol, El Nino is Spanish for the Nino.
But Black Francis, or Frank Black, is super well known for super weird references. So
every time I hear his name, I think of the Bloodhound Gang lyric.
I'm not black like Barry White. No, I am white like Frank Black is. So if man is 5 and the devil is 6, then that must make me 7. This hockey's gone to heaven. But if I go to
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I forgot about that.
Another classic.
Can't wait till we get to do Bloodhound Gang.
Yeah, right, I'm sure.
That's a great pick. I love that song.
Thanks, man.
So, you chose the Foo Fighters, and I was like, all right. So, I went with some Killing Joke, and how I got here, there's a couple ways
I got here.
Yeah. One is the whole Come As You Are, Nirvana, and 80s by Killing Joke, where they might have borrowed a little bit of the riff.
It's the same riff. It's the same riff. Yeah.
It's basically the same riff, just slowed down. Also, on the B-side to Everlong single is a cover of Killing Joke's Requiem. They cover that. Foo Fighters cover that. Bucky Loom is a great Killing Joke song. And I was like, do I pick this one? I'm not going to pick this one. But the Foo Fighters cover, it's all right. It seems their cover of Requiem seems more like we're trying to get our levels and everything in the studio. So we're just jamming on this riff over and over.
Oh, okay.
Oh, we almost had the whole song. Well, I'll just lay some vocals on it and we have an extra track.
Okay.
Like it's got that feel. Like it's missing okay. some stuff to it, but
yeah,
it's all right. You know, it's all right. And then also in 2003... Killing Joke recorded an album and they got Dave Grohl to come in and play all the drums for it. And he basically did refuse payment to do it. Sort of was like as a payback for this whole come as you are 80s thing. So,
totally.
You know, it all comes around and everything's cool. Everyone's cool with it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Illumination. Listen to the drums. Between each beat of the drum. Oh, beloved mother of liberty, hold me in your arms.
So with all that, I was like, which Killing Joke song do I choose? Do I choose one from that album? Do I choose Requiem? Do I choose my favorite Killing Joke song, Millennium? But then I went, you know what? I'm just going to go with Love Like Blood. It's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you never listened to Killing Joke before, their early stuff is very post-punk. I mentioned Requiem, like Metallica's covered The Weight.
The Weight, yeah.
On like Garage EP. So it's got a very like punk attitude to it. After a few albums, they sort of went on this whole like 80s synth like aspect, and that's where you get this song, Love Like Blood. They'd go into more like heavier industrial and more metal incorporated into, I mean, they've always had these things incorporated into their style, but you know, some prevail more than others at times. But Love Like Blood from 1985, it is one of their, I think their biggest hit actually.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, in the States, it was maybe a minor hit. I don't know. In other places,
it was a big hit everywhere else, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty big hit everywhere else. Never heard Killing Joke before? Go for it, you might like it.
I had not heard Killing Joke before this, and I did like it.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's a very distinct, like, I feel like I've heard it before, but I've heard it in so many other bands, but not as well. And yet it has a little bit of a modern feel to it, a little bit of a modern, grungy, almost emo feel to it that I really liked. So I've listened to that one on repeat for a while before I realized it's not my song, and I have to go back and listen to Everlong.
It's funny you said, because when I listen to it, I hear all the bands that ripped them off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this song is basically Dr. Feelgood.
I mean, it is 100% that rhythm with, like, if you took the Dr. Feelgood drum beat, which is one of my favorite drum beats of all time, and somehow, like, mated it with the drum beat from Everlong with the fast 16 hi-hats, this is what you get.
Yeah.
You get this song. Which is amazing. Like, I'm in.
Yeah.
I was in right away. Right from the jump.
Yeah, just kicks in with those drums. Just,
yeah.
And that bass.
Just pounding.
So Killing Joke used to have this guy, Youth, in the band. And mm-hmm. then he dropped out. Well, they sort of, it's a thing. They left.
Parted ways.
Yeah, yeah. They parted ways for a bit. You know, eventually he comes back nice. But at this time, they have Paul Raven on bass. And you just, like, I just love how that bass just fits in, like you said, like Dr. Feelgood,
yeah,
with that drum. It's just so driving, like, like, it just, yeah, drives.
Totally.
And one of my favorite aspects about this song is the guitarist, Jordy, just how he lays the guitar parts over top that heavy groove.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just atmosphere. It's just, yeah, keyboards and the guitar, just the atmosphere on top. And I love when bands do this.
Oh, totally.
So,
man,
much.
Yeah.
See him, like, do a live on, if you pull up, like, later stuff live, I mean, he's doing, like, those, mm-hmm, but at the same time, like, chugging away on the bass parts, too, like the dun 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 dun, and he just keeps going back and forth, like, yeah, no problem, which is really cool. Another thing about that Jordy, the guitar player, is just from the beginning is his tone.
Mm.
That's one thing that a lot of guitar players will pick up on.
Yeah.
Is he's just got great tone. Like, I think Jimmy Page has, like, praised him about his tone.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I read that too. And the singer for this band is a trip, dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You've done a little research on Jazz Coleman.
Yeah, I didn't know much about him. Apparently, there's a lot to know.
Yes, there is. He's a, let's see, he's a singer.
Yeah, orchestra conductor.
Conductor, composer.
Yeah.
Owns
his own hot sauce company.
Yeah. He's got his own hot sauce. An occultist.
An occultist. He's a priest.
That, yeah, those should have been above the other ones. Like, no, occultist, no, what, then hot sauce.
No, I think hot sauce is the top part. Yeah, there's a Killing Joke documentary out. And it's pretty long. It's like almost 3 hours long. Like, it takes a few sittings. It's like 2.5,
wow,
3 hours long.
Okay.
And a lot of it's like really cool information. And then they go into like the whole occult thing.
Oh.
In pieces where they do like, well, we went in this spell.
Yeah.
It goes into that. That's where it sort of loses me at times. In the documentary, I'm like, oh, they can go back to the band stuff.
Yeah. It's pretty clear. Even if you're like picking through Wikipedia or reading the lyrics for this song, even, mm-hmm, like, there's a lot going on in this guy's head. Like,
yeah,
he had,
he's everywhere.
The Wikipedia makes some reference to like the manifesto that the band was operating under. And it's like, but I've been in bands before. Were we supposed to write a manifesto?
That's where you went wrong. You needed a band manifesto.
Yeah.
You didn't burn the black candle and sacrifice a goat.
We did. I mean, we did those things. But as far as like putting anything on paper, no. That's, you know, that's for nerds. But this dude's a trip, man. I loved it. I loved kind of deep diving on.
Just if you see him, like, as he's singing live,
mm-hmm,
just those eyes, like, Satanic Panic in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Has nothing on, like, when you see this guy, like,
well,
his face.
Might have been
live.
Informed by seeing his face.
I don't know if he kicked it off or whatnot, but, like, it's like the Satanic Panic, like the Mercyful, mm-hmm, Fate. It's like, mm-hmm, oh, yeah, that's pretty funny. Like, I thought it was comical.
Right.
But then you see this guy, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm a little scared.
Yeah. right. That's very true.
But yeah, jazz, apart from that, I don't know if anyone out there remembers in the 90s, those symphonic Pink Floyd records and the symphonic Led Zeppelin records, that was Jazz Coleman. Like,
oh,
he was the one
that
conducted and like put all those together. The previous bass player who came back, I think he was producing those as well. You know, when he was like not hanging out with Paul McCartney producing.
Right. Yeah. In a band with Paul McCartney. Weird stuff.
But yeah, I mean, you listen to Killing Joke, you got that early industrial, you got.
For sure.
The whole punk, metal, dance. I mean, you got all in this song, actually.
And the really cool thing about it is that it sounds industrial. Mm-hmm. But it's not like this is not a drum machine.
No,
it's not perfect. By any stretch of the imagination, like when you listen to it, you can hear all the imperfections in it if you're really dialed in, which is something
it's just a straight performance. Yeah.
My brain just does. It's like just hyper tuned into the drums. And so, but I love that. I love that it's like a little bit messy, you know, because it's so fast, like Everlong, but like
there's a lot to do. Yeah.
Everlong came on, like by the time we got to 1997. There was an expectation to perfection that like didn't exist.
No, because back
in
the
80s,
punk,
you know, like
ethos from the 70s, you know,
like it doesn't have to be perfect. Doesn't have to sound like a machine. It kind of does, but you can still tell it's a human being. And that's right. One of the most like charming things about this song to me. I love it.
Yeah. Did you hear about where the lyrics come from?
It has something to do with samurais.
Yes, it comes. From what Jazz Coleman says, it comes from a book he was reading at the time by Yukio Mishima.
Yeah.
The Samurai Ethic in Modern Japan.
I really wanted to read that before this podcast and just come in like loaded up on samurai knowledge, but it didn't happen.
No,
it
didn't happen. But yeah, about using like the actual blood to write and like putting yourself into the art in that sense.
Like,
I guess
like
is where
Kiss in the comic books.
I have
right?
one somewhere.
Just like that. Do you have one of those?
I have one of those.
Jeez.
Somewhere.
This guy never fails to amaze me.
The stuff you pick up.
But yeah, that's the idea, right? For Love Like Blood, the idea is that like you just love that intensely. And I guess if you're an occultist, like whatever, it's just what you spill your blood all over everything, right? But I don't know. It's not a world I traffic in usually.
Only on Saturdays.
Right.
And it's just bass, drum, guitar, keyboards, vocals. Sounds like a lot more, but it isn't.
Yeah. No, similar to the other two songs we talked about, right? Like you bring in this new producer who just really sort of upped their sonic palette and sort of boosted them.
Producing on this one is Chris Kesey.
Yeah.
Kinsey, and he's worked with, let's see, Zeppelin, Stones, Frampton, Marillion, Psychedelic Furs, Choir Boys, Soul Asylum, New Model Army, Cult, and Duran Duran so far. So this guy's done some stuff. Like he engineered like on Stones and I think Zeppelin 3.
Yeah, Sticky Fingers, Some Girls.
A little bit of a pedigree.
That's pretty good. He did Jimmy Cliff. He did Peter Tosh. He did The Cult. This guy's on everything, man. He did my favorite Psychedelic Furs record, Midnight to Midnight.
Yeah.
That makes sense because it has it's like a sonic cousin to Nighttime.
Yeah.
He's good.
Yeah.
The guy's good.
Sarah, any final thoughts on Love Like Blood?
No, just it's added to my Spotify.
Nice. That's the best we can hope for here in the Sonic Temple. I loved it. I'm glad you picked that song. I'm really glad that you picked Everlong.
Yes.
Because I love talking about the Foo Fighters. and I'm so happy that they're continuing on and that we're going to get to see them live again.
Soon. Yeah.
So, yes, Everlong. We'll see it again.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for coming by.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Is there the Sonic Temple here?
The Sonic Temple is impressive.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Sarah, for coming into the Sonic Temple. You can catch her on the Blue Flag Podcast, the F1 podcast that moves aside for all the rest and is your last place for everything Formula One. We're going to go on summer break, so we'll be back in a few months. Don't forget to go rate and subscribe. Be cool. Be safe. Thanks to Legends Rodeo for use of their music on our intro and outro.